to be, the more ACC activation. The ACC is also central to doing something to alleviate someone else's distress. The neuropeptide slash hormone oxytocin gets into the mix. Recall from chapter 4 how it promotes bonding and affiliative behaviors, trust, and generosity. Recall the study in which prairie voles are observed consoling their stressed partner. And we'd expect the effect depends on the actions of oxytocin. Remarkably, the oxytocin works in the ACC. Selectively block oxytocin effects in the ACC, and voles don't console. So how do we go from the ACC as this outpost of self-interest, monitoring your pain and whether you are getting what you think you deserve, to the ACC allowing you to feel the pain of the wretched of the earth? I think the link is a key issue of this chapter. How much is an empathic state actually about yourself? Ouch, that hurt, is a good way to learn not to repeat whatever you just did. But often, even better is to monitor someone else's misfortune. That sure seems to have hurt her. I'm staying away from doing that. Crucially, the ACC is essential for learning fear and conditioned avoidance by observation alone. Going from, she seems to be having a miserable time, to, thus I should avoid that, requires an intervening step of shared representation of self. Like her, I wouldn't enjoy feeling that way. Feeling someone else's pain can be more effective for learning than just knowing that they're in pain. At its core, the ACC is about self-interest, with caring about that other person in pain as an add-on. Other brain regions are pertinent as well. As we saw, maturation of the circuitry of empathy involves bringing into the mix not only the ACC, but the insula as well. By adulthood, the insula, and to a lesser degree the amygdala, is nearly as intertwined with experiencing empathy as is the ACC. The three regions are highly interconnected, and a big chunk of the amygdala texting the frontal cortex is funneled through the ACC. Numerous circumstances that evoke a sense of empathy, particularly physical pain, activate the insula along with the ACC, with the magnitude of the response correlating with the subject's basic proclivity toward empathy or the subjective sense of empathy they are feeling in the situation. This makes sense, given the workings of the insula and amygdala. As we saw, their involvement in empathic states emerges developmentally as kids first embed empathy in context and causality. Why is this person in pain, and whose fault is it? This is obvious when pain is rooted in injustice, when disgust, indignation, and anger sweep in because we know that this pain could have been prevented, that someone profited from it. Even when it is unclear that a cause of pain lies in injustice, we seek attribution. The intertwining of the ACC with the insula and amygdala is our world of scapegoating. And that pattern is so often there, even when pain is random, without human agency or villainy. Literal or metaphorical tectonic plates shift. The earth opens up and swallows someone innocent, and we rail against the people who deprived that victim of a happier life before the tragedy struck, against the God behind this act of God, against the mechanistic indifference of the universe. And as we will see, the more the purity of empathy is clouded with the anger, disgust, and indignation of blame, the harder it is to actually help. The cognitive side of things. When do the more cognitive components of an empathic state, the PFC, the DLPFC in particular, along with theory of mind networks such as the temporoparietal juncture, TPJ, and superior central sulcus, come more to the forefront? Obviously, and uninterestingly, when it's challenging to even figure out what's going on. Wait, who won the game? Do I want my pieces to surround or be surrounded by the other person's? More interesting is when more cognitive brain circuitry is recruited by issues of causation and intentionality. Wait, does he have a horrible headache because he's a migrant farm worker who was sprayed with pesticide, or because he's been binge drinking with his frat bros? Did this AIDS patient get his HIV from a blood transfusion or drug use? People show more activation of the ACC for the former. This is precisely what Chimsa thought through when comforting an innocent victim of aggression, but not an instigator. As we saw in Chapter 7, the more cognitive profile of activation emerges when kids start distinguishing between self and other inflicted pain. In the words of Jean de Citi, who did such research, this demonstrates that empathic arousal was moderated early in information processing by a priori attitudes toward other people. In other words, cognitive processes serve as a gatekeeper, deciding whether a particular misfortune is worthy of empathy. It is also a cognitive task to resonate with pain that is less overt. For example, there is more engagement of the DMPFC when observing someone in emotional pain than physical pain. Likewise, when the pain is presented more abstractly, a signal on a screen indicating that someone's hand has been stuck with a needle versus the act itself being shown. Resonating with someone else's pain is also a cognitive task when it is a type of pain that you haven't experienced. Well, I suppose I can understand the disappointment of this militia leader when he was passed over for the chance to carry out the ethnic cleansing, kinda like when I lost the election in kindergarten to be president of the Random Act of Kindness Club. Now, that takes cognitive work. In one study, subjects considered people suffering from a neurological disorder involving a novel type of pain sensitivity. Empathizing for that novel pain involved more frontal cortical activation than for more conventional pain. As we saw, the rudimentary empathy of rodents is contingent, depending on whether the other individual is a cage mate or a stranger. It is an enormous cognitive task for humans to overcome that, to reach an empathic state for someone who is different, unappealing. A hospital chaplain once described to me how he has to actively make sure that he is not preferentially visiting patients who were YAVIS, young, attractive, verbal, intelligent, or social. This is straight out of us versus them. Recall Susan Fiske's work showing how extreme outgroup members, such as the homeless or addicts, are processed differently in the frontal cortex than other people. And it is also straight out of Josh Green's Tragedy of the Commons versus Tragedy of the Common Sense morality, where acting morally toward an us is automatic, while doing so for a them takes work. The ease of empathizing with people like us starts at the level of autonomic building blocks of empathy. In one study of ritual firewalkers in Spain, heart rate changes in the walkers synchronized with spectators, but only those who were relatives. In line with that distinction, taking the perspective of a loved one in pain activates the ACC. Doing the same for a stranger activates the TPJ, that region central to theory of mind. This extends to broader versions of us versus them. As introduced in Chapter 3, we have a stronger sensory-motor response in our hands when the hand we see being poked with a needle is of our race. The stronger one's implicit in-group bias, the stronger this effect. Meanwhile, other studies show that the stronger the discrepancy in patterns of neural activation when observing an in-group versus an out-group person in pain, the lower the chances of helping the latter. Thus, it's no surprise that feeling the same degree of empathy or achieving the same level of perspective taking for them as for an us requires greater frontocortical activation. This is the domain where you must suppress the automatic and implicit urges to be indifferent, if not repulsed, and do the creative, motivated work of finding the affective commonalities. Footnote. It can be an informative political litmus test to consider whose pain you readily feel, e.g., a fetus versus a homeless person. What it means to be liberal or conservative became ideologically solidified around the problem of empathy for only certain types of pain, writes one political scientist. Categorical boundaries to the extension of empathy also run along socioeconomic lines, but in an asymmetrical manner. What does that mean? That when it comes to empathy and compassion, rich people tend to suck. This has been explored at length in a series of studies by Dacher Keltner of UC Berkeley. Across the socioeconomic spectrum, on the average, the wealthier people are, the less empathy they report for people in distress and the less compassionately they act. Moreover, wealthier people are less adept at recognizing other people's emotions, and in experimental settings are greedier and more likely to cheat or steal. Two of the findings were picked up by the media as irresistible. A, wealthier people, as assessed by the cost of the car they were driving, are less likely than poor people to stop for pedestrians at crosswalks. B, suppose there's a bowl of candy in a lab. Invite test subjects, after they finish doing some task, to grab some candy on the way out, telling them that whatever's left over will be given to some kids. The wealthier take more candy. So, do miserable, greedy, unempathic people become wealthy? Or does being wealthy increase the odds of a person's becoming that way? As a cool manipulation, Keltner primed subjects to focus either on their socioeconomic success by asking them to compare themselves with people less well-off than them, or on the opposite. Make people feel wealthy, and they take more candy from children. What explains this pattern? A number of interrelated factors, built around the system justification described in Chapter 12. Wealthier people are more likely to endorse greed as being good, to view the class system as fair and meritocratic, and to view their success as an act of independence. All great ways to decide that someone else's distress is beneath your notice or concern. It is a particularly uphill battle when we are asked to empathize with the pain of people we dislike, whom we morally disapprove of. Remember how their misfortune doesn't simply fail to activate the ACC, but instead it activates mesolimbic dopamine reward pathways. Thus, the process of taking their perspective and feeling their pain, as other than grounds for gloating, is a dramatic cognitive challenge, rather than something remotely automatic. The cognitive costs of empathizing with someone distant are shown by increasing people's cognitive load, i.e. making their frontal cortex work harder by forcing it to override a habitual behavior. They become less helpful to strangers, but not to family members. Empathy fatigue can thus be viewed as the state when the cognitive load of repeated exposure to the pain of thems, whose perspective is challenging to take, has exhausted the frontal cortex. The notions of cognitive work and load also help explain why people are more charitable when contemplating one person in need than a group. To quote Mother Teresa, "If I look at the mass, I will never act. If I look at the one, I will." Or to cite a quote attributed to someone who never seems to have achieved enough empathy to be vulnerable to empathy fatigue, Joseph Stalin. "The death of one man is a tragedy. The death of millions is a statistic." And probably most reliably, those mentalizing pathways are activated when we switch from focusing on what it would feel like if this were happening to us to focusing on what it must feel like for them. Thus, when subjects are instructed to switch from first to third person perspective, there's not just activation of the TPJ, but also frontal activation with a top-down regulatory task. Stop thinking about yourself. Thus, we have themes that closely resemble those from the last few chapters. When it comes to empathic states, emotion and cognition are totally false dichotomies. You need both, but with the balance between the two shifting on a continuum. And the cognition end of it has to do the heavy lifting when the differences between you and the person in pain initially swap the similarities. Time now for one of the great sideshows in empathy science. A mythic leap forward. In the early 1990s, scientists at the University of Parma in Italy, led by Giacomo Rizzolatti and Vittorio Galesi, reported something that, depending on your tastes, ranged from really interesting to revolutionary. They had been studying an area of the brain called the premotor cortex, PMC, in rhesus monkeys, examining what sorts of stimuli would cause individual neurons there to activate. Back to the PMC from Chapter 2. Executive neurons in the PFC decide something, passing the news to the rest of the frontal cortex just behind it, which sends projections to the PMC just behind it, which sends projections one step further back to the motor cortex, which then sends commands to muscles. Thus, the PMC straddles the divide between thinking about and carrying out a movement. The group had discovered some mighty quirky PMC neurons. Suppose a monkey carried out a behavior, grasping some food and bringing it to her mouth. Naturally, some neurons in the PMC would have activated. If she did a different movement, grasping an object and placing it in a container, a different, partially overlapping, array of PMC neurons were involved. What the group reported was that some of the bring-food-to-mouth neurons would also activate if the monkey observed someone else, monkey or human, making that movement. Same for some of the place-object-in-container neurons. Same for subtler movements like facial expressions. Consistently, about 10% of the PMC neurons devoted to doing movement X also activated when observing someone else doing movement X. Very odd for neurons a few steps away from commanding muscles to move. The neurons were concerned with the mirroring of movements, and thus were mirror neurons announced to the world. Naturally, everyone looked for mirror neurons in humans, and their existence in roughly the same part of the brain was soon inferred with brain imaging studies. Inferred because that approach tells you about the activity of large numbers of neurons at a time rather than single ones. Then individual neurons were shown to be mirror-esque in humans, in patients undergoing neurosurgery to control a rare type of epilepsy. The mirroring can be quite abstract. It can be cross-modal. See someone doing movement A, and some mirror neuron activates. Hear the sound of someone doing movement A, and the same occurs. And the neurons can gestalt a scene, firing even if only part of the observed movement is obscured. Most interesting, mirror neurons didn't simply track movement. Find a mirror neuron that responds to the sight of someone picking up a cup of tea to drink. The sight of someone picking up the tea to clear the table doesn't activate it. In other words, mirror neurons can incorporate intentionality into their response. Thus, mirror neuron activity correlates with circumstances of imitation, either conscious or otherwise, including imitating the idea of an action, as well as the intent behind it. Nevertheless, no one has actually shown a causal relationship that automatic or conscious mimicry requires mirror neuron activation. Moreover, the mirror neuron slash imitation link is complicated by the cells having been first identified in rhesus monkeys, a species that does not show imitation of behavior. But assuming that mirror neurons are indeed involved, the question becomes what purpose mimicry serves. Various possibilities have been raised and debated. Probably the least controversial and most plausible is that mirror neurons mediate motor learning by observation. Downsides of this theory, though, are that A, mirror neurons do their thing in species with minimal learning by mimicry. B, the amount of mirror neuron activity is unrelated to the efficacy with which observational learning of movements occurs. C, to the extent that mirror neurons are needed for types of observational learning, it's a pretty low-level contribution in humans. After all, while we do learn how to carry out certain motoric acts by observation, far more interesting is our learning of context by observation. When to carry out that behavior. For example, observational learning may teach a subordinate primate the motoric features of kowtowing, but far more demanding and important is learning whom to kowtow to. Related to that is the idea of mirror neurons aiding learning from another person's experience. If you observe someone biting into food and they grimace at its taste, having mirror neurons at the intersection of observing that expression and experiencing it yourself will certainly make more vivid your understanding that you should probably avoid that food. This is an idea advocated by Gregory Hickok of the University of California at Irvine, who, as we'll see, is a hard-nosed critic of mirror neuron flights of fancy. This harks back to Chapter 2 and Antonio Damasio's influential somatic marker hypothesis, the idea that when we are choosing among difficult options, the frontal cortex runs as if experiments, canvassing your mind's and body's responses to doing X or Y, a thought experiment combined with a gut feeling experiment. mirror neurons, with their putative attunement to how things worked out for observed individuals, would certainly weigh into this process. Thus, mirror neurons might be useful for learning the meaning of a movement, how to carry it out more effectively, and the consequences for someone else who did it. Nonetheless, such neuronal activity is neither necessary nor sufficient for observational learning, especially of the most interesting, abstract human kinds. Then there's the next, more controversial realm, namely the idea that mirror neurons help you understand what someone else is thinking. This can range from understanding what behavior they are doing, to understanding why they are doing it, to grasping their larger motivations, all the way to peering into their souls with your mirror neurons. You can see why this has spawned debates. In this view, mirror neurons aid theory of mind, mind reading, and perspective taking, suggesting that part of how we understand someone else's world is by simulating, in our minds, in our PMC, in our mirror neurons, their actions. This orients a mirror neuron's world in a very different way from the previous section, where mirroring is to improve your own motor performance, and the most pertinent neuroanatomy about mirror neurons in the PMC is their talking to motor neurons that command muscles. In contrast, mirror neurons being concerned with understanding someone else's actions should be talking to theory of mind-related brain regions, for which there is evidence. There was also the suggestion that mirror neuron-mediated perspective-taking is particularly concerned with social interactions. Rizzolatti, for example, showed that mirror neuron activity was greater when the observed individual was closer. But importantly, this isn't just literal distance, but something resembling social distance. As evidence, mirror neuron activity would decrease if there was a transparent barrier between the observer and observed. In Galesi's words, this shows the relevance of mirror neurons when mapping the potentialities for competition or cooperation between agent and observer. The notion that mirror neurons aid us in understanding someone else's actions, leading to our understanding someone else, period, has been heavily criticized on two grounds, most notably by Hickok. First is the issue of causality. While some studies show that mirror neuron activity correlates with attempts at understanding someone else's perspective, there is minimal evidence that such activity causes the understanding. The second criticism concerns something obvious. We can understand the intent behind someone else's actions, even if we can't remotely perform them ourselves. This would apply to actions of the observed individual ranging from pole vaulting 18 feet to explaining special relativity. Supporters of this role for mirror neurons admit this, but argue that they provide an extra level of understanding. Galesi writes, "I submit that it is only through the activation of mirror neurons that we can grasp the meaning of others' behavior from within." My emphasis. This is not my area of research, and I'm not trying to be snarky, but it seems like he's saying that there's understanding, and then there's super-duper understanding, and the latter requires mirror neurons. These mirror neuron speculations have been extended to focus on autism, a disorder in which there are profound impairments in understanding other people's actions and intentions. According to the broken mirror hypothesis of mirror neuron pioneer Marco Iacoboni of UCLA, mirror neuron dysfunction underlies those aspects of autism. This has been examined by scads of researchers, with findings varying depending on the paradigm. Most meta-analyses conclude that there is nothing flagrantly wrong with the formal features of mirror neuron function in autistic individuals. Thus, while mirror neurons' activity correlates with attempts to understand other people's actions, their involvement seems neither necessary nor sufficient, and is most pertinent to low-level, concrete aspects of such understanding. As for mirror neurons being the portal for peering into someone's soul and attaining super-duper understanding from within, I think things are best summarized by the title of Hickok's well-received 2014 book, The Myth of Mirror Neurons, which leads to the wild west of mirror neuronology, with speculations that mirror neurons are essential to language, aesthetics, consciousness. Most of all, within 2 seconds of people first hearing about mirror neurons, they started writing reviews where the last paragraph would say something like, "Wow, mirror neurons! How cool is that? This opens up all sorts of interesting avenues. Maybe they even explain empathy." Sure, why not? Feeling someone's pain is like mirroring their experience, feeling as if you are them. Tailor-made, an irresistible idea. And in the decades since mirror neurons' discovery, the maybe-they-even-explain-empathy reviews have continued. Gillespie, for example, nearly 20 years into the mirror neuron era, speculates, "I proposed the mirroring could be a basic functional principle of our brain, and that our capacity to empathize with others might be mediated by embodied stimulation mechanisms, i.e. mirroring." Iacoboni, at the same time, writes, "Mirror neurons are likely cellular candidates for the core layer of empathy." There have been some supportive hints. For example, people who self-report being particularly empathic show stronger mirror neuron-esque responses to matching movements. But for skeptics, everything else is mere speculation. That's disappointing, but worse is people skipping over the maybe and concluding that mirror neurons have been proven to mediate empathy. Iacoboni, for example, mistakes correlation for causality. Other studies, however, show that PMC activity correlates with empathy even when subjects watch grasping actions without overt emotional content. Thus, the mirror neuron activity is a prerequisite for experiencing empathy, my emphasis. A flagrant example of this is the neuroscientist Vilayanur Ramachandran of UC San Diego, one of the most flamboyantly creative people in the business, doing fascinating research on phantom limbs, synesthesia, and out-of-body experiences. He's brilliant, but has gotten a bit giddy with mirror neurons. A sampling. "We know that my mirror neurons can literally feel your pain." He's called them the driving force behind the great leap forward into human behavioral modernity 60,000 years ago, and famously said, "Mirror neurons will do for psychology what DNA did for biology." I'm not trying to harp on Ramachandran, but how can you resist someone brilliant handing out sound bites like calling mirror neurons Gandhi neurons? And this wasn't just in the first heady days of mirror neurons in the early 1990s. 2 decades later, he stated, "I don't think the importance of mirror neurons for empathy is being exaggerated. I think they're being played down, actually." Ramachandran is certainly not alone. British philosopher Anthony Grayling has gone for the empathy link big time, writing, "We have a great gift for empathy. This is a biologically evolved capacity as shown by the function of mirror neurons." In a 2007 New York Times article about one man's heroic actions to save another, those cells featured again. People have mirror neurons which make them feel what someone else is experiencing, emphasis added. And of course, there was my daughter's 6-year-old classmate who, upon the class being complimented by their teacher for caring about the planet and cleaning up after their Earth Day cupcake celebration, shouted out, "It's because our neurons have mirrors." I'd like to think that I'm being a maverick here, ahead of the crowd in terms of crucial thinking, but in recent years, most in the field have charged over hype. Psychologist Gary Marcus of NYU calls mirror neurons the most oversold idea in psychology. Philosopher and neuroscientist Patricia Churchland of UCSD calls them the darling of the don't-look-too-closely crew. And Harvard's Steven Pinker concludes, "Mirror neurons do not, in fact, explain language, empathy, society, and world peace." They simply haven't been shown to have much to do with this chapter's concerns. The core issue, actually doing something. The previous chapter considered the world of difference between highfalutin moral reasoning and whether, at a crucial juncture, someone actually does the right thing. As we saw, there is something consistent about that latter type of person. What were you thinking when you leaped into that river to save the child? I wasn't. Before I knew it, I jumped in. An act of implicit automaticity, the product of a childhood in which doing the right thing was ingrained as an automatic moral imperative light years away from the frontal cortex calculating costs and benefits. We face a similar situation here, one that is the core of this chapter. Sympathy versus empathy. For versus as if. Affect versus cognition. What we do versus what other species do. Does any of this actually predict who does something compassionate to lessen someone's pains? Similarly, does any of this predict whether the person acting compassionately acts effectively? And how much it's an act of self-interest? As we'll see, there is a yawning gap between being in an empathic state and acting effectively in a way that is truly selfless. Doing something. It is far from guaranteed that an empathic state leads to a compassionate act. One reason for this is captured superbly by the essayist Leslie Jameson. Empathy can also offer a dangerous sense of completion, that something has been done because something has been felt. It is tempting to think that feeling someone's pain is necessarily virtuous in its own right. The peril of empathy isn't simply that it can make us feel bad, but that it can make us feel good, which can in turn encourage us to think of empathy as an end in itself rather than part of a process, a catalyst. In such a situation, saying, "I feel your pain," becomes a New Age equivalent of the unhelpful bureaucrat saying, "Look, I sympathize with your situation, but..." The former is so detached from action that it doesn't even require the "but" as a bridge to the "there's nothing I can slash will do." Having your pain validated is swell. Having it alleviated is better. And there's a broader reason why an empathic state may not produce action, first raised in Chapter 6 when considering those strange creatures, adolescents. In that discussion, I emphasized a wonderful feature of so many adolescents, namely the frenzied feeling of the world's pains, but noted how that intensity often leads to little more than frenzied self-absorption. If instead of imagining how someone else is feeling, an other-oriented perspective, you are imagining how it would feel if this were happening to you, a self-oriented perspective, you has just come to the forefront, and the main point is that feeling someone's pain feels painful. The biological substrates of this are clear. Look at someone in pain with the instruction to take a self-oriented perspective, and the amygdala, ACC, and insular cortex activate, along with reports of distress and anxiety. Do the same with an other-oriented perspective, and all are less likely. And the more extreme the former state, the more likely that someone's focus will be to lessen their own distress, to metaphorically look the other way. This can be predicted with remarkable ease. Expose subjects to evidence of someone else in pain. If their heart rate increases a lot, a peripheral indicator of anxious amygdaloid arousal, they are unlikely to act pro-socially in the situation. The pro-social ones are those whose heart rates decrease. They can hear the sound of someone else's need instead of the distressed pounding in their own chests. Thus, if feeling your pain makes me feel awful, I'm likely to just look out for number one rather than helping you. Likewise, if you've got your own issues. We saw this earlier with a demonstration that if you increase people's cognitive load, they become less pro-social towards strangers. Similarly, when people are hungry, they are less charitable. "Hey, quit belly aching about your problems. My belly is aching." Make people feel socially excluded, and they become less generous and empathic. Stress has the same effect, working via glucocorticoids. Mogul's group, with my involvement, recently showed that if you use a drug to block glucocorticoid secretion, both mice and humans become more empathic towards strangers. Thus, if you feel highly distressed, whether due to resonating with someone else's problems or because of your own, tending to your own needs readily becomes the priority. In other words, empathic states are most likely to produce compassionate acts when we manage a detached distance. This brings to mind the anecdote from many chapters ago about the Buddhist monk I encountered who said that, yes, sometimes he cuts short his cross-legged meditation because of his knees, but not because he feels them hurting. "I do it as an act of kindness to my knees." and this is certainly in line with the Buddhist approach to compassion, which views it as a simple, detached, self-evident imperative rather than as requiring vicarious froth. You act compassionately toward one individual because of a globalized sense of wishing good things for the world. A handful of fascinating studies of Buddhist monks have been carried out both by Richard Davidson of the University of Wisconsin and Tanya Singer of the Max Planck Institutes in Germany. Remarkably, given the science versus religion culture wars, such work was given its blessing and facilitated by the Dalai Lama, who is famously intrigued by neuroscience and who has said that if his Dalai Lama gig hadn't come up, he would have wanted to be a scientist or engineer. The most publicized work revolves around the neuroimaging of Mathieu Ricard, a French-born Buddhist monk who is the Dalai Lama's French translator and who just happens to have a PhD in molecular biology from the Pasteur Institute. This is one interesting guy. When confronted with examples of human suffering and instructed to empathically feel the pain of those people, Ricard showed activation of the same circuitry as you'd see in most everyone else, and it was extremely aversive. The empathic sharing very quickly became intolerable to me, and I felt emotionally exhausted, he explained. When instead he did his Buddhist thing, focusing on thoughts of compassion, a totally different picture of activation emerged. The amygdala was silent, and instead there was heavy activation of the mesolimbic dopamine system. He described it as a warm, positive state associated with a strong pro-social motivation. In other studies, volunteers underwent either empathy training, focusing on feeling the pain of someone in distress, or compassion training, focusing on a feeling of warmth and care toward that distressed person. The former would generate the typical neuroimaging profiles, including heavy amygdala activation and a negative anxious state. Those with compassion training did not, showing heavy activation instead in the cognitive DLPFC, coupling of activation between the DLPFC and dopaminergic regions, more positive emotions, and a greater tendency toward pro-sociality. Okay, caveats. This is a tiny literature, i.e., not much larger than the study of Ricard. And all-star Buddhist monks apparently meditate 8 hours a day, not a trivial path to take. The point is merely to emphasize this scenario of detachment. Which brings us to the next issue, which is whether compassionate acts fostered by empathy are necessarily useful. Doing something effectively. In a provocatively titled 2014 article, Against Empathy, Paul Bloom explored the ways in which empathy can lead to compassionate acts that are far from ideal. There is the realm of what has been termed pathological altruism, the type associated with codependency. This is the scenario of someone so consumed with the vicarious pain of a loved one that they endure and facilitate his dysfunction rather than administering tough love. Then there's the danger that the empathic pain is so intense that you can only come up with solutions that would work for you rather than ones that might help the sufferer. And there is the problem of empathy impeding your doing what's necessary. It's not great if a parent is so vicariously distressed by their child being distressed that they forego vaccinations. A large piece of the training of healthcare professionals is teaching them to keep empathy at bay. For example, the various behavioral and neurobiological responses to seeing someone poked with a needle do not occur in acupuncturists. As Jameson describes, when anxiously seeing a doctor about something worrisome, I needed to look at him and see the opposite of my fear, not its echo. Bloom also emphasizes how highly aroused empathy pushes us towards psychologically easy acts that generate the least cognitive load. In those times, suffering that is local, that concerns an identified, appealing individual, and that is of a type with which you're familiar, readily counts for more than suffering that is distant, involves a group, and is an alien form of pain. Aroused empathy produces tunnel-visioned compassion that can wind up misplaced. As the philosopher Jesse Prince emphasizes, the point is not whose pain pains us the most, but who most needs our help. Are there ever any bloody altruists? Stop the presses. Science has proven that it can feel good to do good, complete with activation of the mesolimbic dopamine system. This doesn't even require a brain scanner. In a 2008 study in Science, subjects were given either $5 or $20. Half were instructed to spend it that day on themselves, half on someone else, ranging from a friend to a charity. And comparisons of self-assessments of happiness at the beginning and end of the day showed that neither the larger amount of money nor the opportunity to spend it on oneself increased happiness. Only spending it on someone else did. And particularly interesting is that other subjects, told about the design, predicted the opposite, that happiness would be raised most by spending on oneself, and that $20 would buy more happiness than $5. The question, of course, is why doing good can feel good, which raises the classic question, is there ever a selfless act that contains no element of self-interest? Does doing good feel good because there's something in it for you? I'm sure not going to tackle this from a philosophical perspective. For biologists, the most frequent stance is anchored in Chapter 10's evolutionary view of cooperation and altruism, one that always contains some element of self-interest. Is this surprising? Pure selflessness is clearly going to be an uphill battle if the very part of the brain most central to an empathic state, the ACC, evolved to observe and learn from others' pain for your own benefit. The self-oriented rewards of acting compassionately are endless. There's the interpersonal, leaving the beneficiary in your debt, thus turfing this from altruism to reciprocal altruism. There are the public benefits of reputation and acclaim, the celebrity swooping into a refugee camp for a photo op with starving kids, made joyful by her incandescent presence. There's that strange version of reputation that comes in the rare cultures that have invented a moralizing god, one who monitors human behavior and rewards or punishes accordingly. As we saw in Chapter 9, it is only when cultures get large enough that there are anonymous interactions among strangers that they tend to invent moralizing gods. A recent study shows that across a worldwide range of religions, the more people perceive their god or gods to monitor and punish, the more pro-social they are in an anonymous interaction. Thus, there is the self-interested benefit of tipping the cosmic scale in your favor. And probably most inaccessibly, there is the purely internal reward of altruism, the warm glow of having done good, the lessened sting of guilt, the increased sense of connection to others, the solidifying sense of being able to include goodness in your self-definition. Science has been able to catch the self-interest component of empathy in the act. As noted, some of the self-interest reflects concerns about self-definition. Personality profiles show that the more charitable people are, the more they tend to define themselves by their charitability. Which comes first? It's impossible to tell, but highly charitable people tend to have been brought up by parents who were charitable and who emphasized charitable acts as a moral imperative, particularly in a religious context. How about the self-interested reputational rewards of being altruistic? The cachet of conspicuous largesse rather than conspicuous consumption? As emphasized in Chapter 10, people become more pro-social when reputation rides on it. And personality profiles also show that highly charitable people tend to be particularly dependent on external approval. Two of the studies just cited that showed dopaminergic activation when people were being charitable came with a catch. Subjects were given money and, while in a brain scanner, decided whether to keep the money or donate. Being charitable activated dopamine reward systems when there was an observer present. When no one was present, dopamine tended to flow most when subjects kept the money for themselves. As emphasized by the 12th century philosopher Moses Maimonides, the purest form of charity, the most stripped of self-interest, is when both the giver and the recipient are anonymous. And, as shown in those brain scanners, this is perhaps the rarest form as well. Intuitively, if good acts must be motivated by self-interest, The reputational motive, the desire to be the biggest spender at the charity auction, seems most worthy of irony. In contrast, the motivation to think of yourself as a good person seems a pretty benign one. After all, we're all searching for a sense of self, and better that particular sense than to assure yourself that you're tough, scary, and not to be messed with. Is the element of self-interest ever truly absent? One 2007 study in Science examined this. Subjects, in brain scanners of course, were unexpectedly given varying amounts of money. Then, some of the time, they were taxed, i.e., told that a certain percentage of that money would be forcibly given to a food bank. Some of the time given the opportunity to donate that amount voluntarily. In other words, the exact same amount of public good was accomplished in each case, but the former constituted enforced civic duty, while the latter was a purely charitable act. Thus, if someone's altruism is purely other-oriented, without a smidgen of self-interest, the two circumstances are psychologically identical. Those in need are being helped, and that's all that matters. And the more different the scenarios feel, the more self-interest is coming into play. The results were complex and interesting. A. The more people's dopaminergic reward systems activated when they unexpectedly received money, the less activation there was when they were either taxed or asked to donate. In other words, the greater the love of money, the more painfully it is parted with. No surprise there. B. The more dopaminergic activation there was when someone was taxed, the more voluntarily charitable they were. Being taxed could not have been welcome to the most self-interested. Money was being taken from them. For subjects who instead showed heavy activation of dopaminergic systems in that circumstance, any self-interest of losing money was more than compensated for by the knowledge that people in need were being helped. This taps into the last chapter's exploration of inequity aversion and is consistent with findings that in some circumstances, when a pair of strangers are openly given unequal amounts of reward, there is typically dopaminergic activation in the one with the good luck when some of the reward is transferred afterward to make things more even. Thus, it's little surprise in the present study that subjects made happy by reducing inequity, even at a cost to themselves, were also the most charitable. The authors appropriately interpret this as reflecting a compassionate act with elements independent of self-interest. C. There was more dopaminergic activation and more self-reports of satisfaction when people gave voluntarily than when they were taxed. In other words, a component of the charitability was about self-interest. It was more pleasing when those in need were helped by voluntary efforts than when giving was forced. What does this show? That we're reinforced by varying things and to varying extents. Getting money? Knowing that the needy are being cared for. Feeling the warm glow of doing a good thing. And that it is rare to be able to get the second type of pleasure with no dependence on the third. It appears to truly be rare to scratch an altruist and see an altruist bleed. Conclusions. All things considered, it is a pretty remarkable thing that when an individual is in pain, we, i.e., we humans, primates, mammals, often are induced to be in a state of pain also. There have been some mighty interesting twists and turns for that one to have evolved. But at the end of the day, the crucial issue is whether an empathic state actually produces a compassionate act, to avoid the trap of empathy being an end unto itself. The gap between the state and the act can be enormous, especially when the goal is for the act to be not only effective, but also pristine in its motives. For someone reading this book, a first challenge in bridging that gap is that much of the world's suffering is felt by distant masses experiencing things that we haven't an inkling of, diseases that don't touch us, poverty that precludes clean water, a place to live, the certainty of a next meal, oppression at the hands of political systems that we've been spared, strictures due to repressive cultural norms that might as well be from another planet. And everything about us makes those the hardest scenarios for us to actually act. Everything about our hominin past has honed us to be responsive to one face at a time, to a face that is local and familiar, to a source of pain that we ourselves have suffered. Yes, best that our compassion be driven by the most need rather than by the most readily shared pain. Nevertheless, there's no reason why we should expect ourselves to have particularly good intuitions when aiming to heal this far-flung, heterogeneous world. We probably need to be a bit easier on ourselves in this regard. Likewise, we should perhaps ease up a bit on the scratching an altruist problem. It has always struck me as a bit mean-spirited to conclude that it is a hypocrite who bleeds. Scratch an altruist, and most of the time, the individual with impure motives who bleeds is merely the product of altruism and reciprocity being evolutionarily inseparable. Better that our good acts be self-serving and self-aggrandizing than that they don't occur at all. Better that the myths we construct and propagate about ourselves are that we are gentle and giving, rather than that we prefer to be feared than loved, and that we aim to live well as the best revenge. Finally, there is the challenge of a compassionate act being left by the wayside when the empathic state is sufficiently real and vivid and awful. I'm not advocating that people become Buddhists in order to make the world a better place. Nor am I advocating that people don't become Buddhists. What is the sound of one atheist waffling? Most of us typically require moments of piercing, frothing, shared pain to even notice those around us in need. Our intuitions run counter to doing it any other way. After all, just as one of the most frightening versions of humans at their worst is cold-blooded killing, one of the most puzzling and even off-putting of us at our best is cold-blooded kindness. Yet, as we've seen, a fair degree of detachment is just what is needed to actually act. Better that than our hearts racing in pained synchrony with the heart of someone suffering, if that cardiovascular activation mostly primes us to flee when it all becomes just too much to bear. Which brings us to a final point. Yes, you don't act because someone else's pain is so painful. That's a scenario that begs you to flee instead. But the detachment that should be aimed for doesn't represent choosing a cognitive approach to doing good over an affective one. The detachment isn't slowly, laboriously thinking your way to acting compassionately as an ideal utilitarian solution. The danger here is the ease with which you can instead think your way to conveniently concluding this isn't your problem to worry about. The key is neither a good limbic heart nor a frontal cortex that can reason you to the point of action. Instead, it's the case of things that have long since become implicit and automatic. Being potty trained, riding a bike, telling the truth, helping someone in need. Chapter 15. Metaphors We Kill By. Example 1. Stretching back at least to that faux pas about the golden calf at Mount Sinai, various branches of Abrahamic religions have had a thing about graven images, which has given us aniconism, the banning of icons, and iconoclasts, who destroy offensive images on religious grounds. Orthodox Judaism has been into that at times, ditto for Calvinists, especially when it came to those idolatrous Catholics. Currently, it's branches of Sunni Islam that deploy literal graven image police and consider the height of offense to be images of Allah and Muhammad. In September 2005, the Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten published cartoon images of Muhammad on its editorial page. It was a protest against Danish censorship and self-censorship about the subject, against Islam being a sacred cow in a Western democracy where other religions are readily criticized satirically. None of the cartoons suggested reverence or respect. Many explicitly linked Muhammad with terrorism, e.g., him wearing a bomb as a turban. Many were ironic about the ban. Muhammad is a stick figure with a turban. Muhammad, armed with a sword, with a blackened rectangle over his eyes. Muhammad in a police lineup alongside other bearded men with turbans. And as a direct result of the cartoons, Western embassies and consulates were attacked, even burned, in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Libya. Churches were burned in northern Nigeria. Protesters were killed in Afghanistan, Egypt, Gaza, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Libya, Nigeria, Pakistan, Somalia, and Turkey, typically either by mob stampedes or by police containing rioters. And non-Muslims were killed in Nigeria, Italy, Turkey, and Egypt as revenge for the cartoons. In July 2007, drawings by a Swedish artist of Muhammad's head with a dog's body provoked much of the same. In addition to deadly protests, the Islamic State of Iraq offered $100,000 for the artist's killing. Al-Qaeda targeted the artist for death, along with staffers from Jyllands-Posten. Assassination plots were stopped by Western authorities, and one attempt killed two bystanders. In May 2015, two gunmen attacked an anti-Anaconist event in Texas, where a $10,000 prize was offered for the best depiction of Muhammad. One person was injured before the gunmen were killed by police. And, of course, on January 7, 2015, two brothers, French-born sons of Algerian immigrants, massacred the staff of Charlie Hebdo, killing 12. Example 2. In the Battle of Gettysburg, fierce fighting occurred between the Union 1st Minnesota Volunteer Infantry and Confederate 28th Virginia Volunteer Infantry Regiment. At one point, Confederate soldier John Eakin, carrying the regimental flag of the 28th Virginia, was shot three times, a typical fate of soldiers carrying the colors who were preferential targets. Mortally wounded, Eakin handed the flag to a comrade who was promptly killed. The flag was then taken up and displayed by Colonel Robert Allen, who was soon killed, then by Lieutenant John Lee, who was soon injured. A Union soldier attempting to seize the colors was killed by Confederates. Finally, Private Marshall Sherman of the 1st Minnesota captured the flag along with Lee. Examples 3, 4, and 5. In mid-2015, Tavon Price, a mentally challenged 19-year-old, was killed by gangbangers in Los Angeles for wearing red shoes, a rival gang's color. His dying words in front of his mother were, "Mommy, please. I don't want to die. Mommy, please." In October 1980, Irish Republican prisoners at the Mays Prison in Northern Ireland began a hunger strike, protesting, among other things, their being denied political prisoner status by having to wear prison garb. The British government acceded to their demands as a first prisoner slipped into a coma 53 days later. In a similar strike, a year later in the Mays, 10 Irish political prisoners starved themselves to death over 46 to 73 days. By 2010, karaoke clubs throughout the Philippines had removed the Frank Sinatra song My Way from their playlists because of violent responses to the singing of it, including a dozen killings. Some of the My Way killings were due to poor renditions, which apparently often results in killings. But most were thought linked to the macho lyrics. "I did it my way. It's so arrogant." The lyrics evoke feelings of pride and arrogance in the singer, as if you're somebody when you're really nobody. "It covers up your failures. That's why it leads to fights," explained the owner of a singing school in Manila to the New York Times. In other words, people are willing to kill or be killed over a cartoon, a flag, a piece of clothing, a song. We have some explaining to do. Throughout this book, we've repeatedly gained insights into humans by examining other species. Some of the time, the similarities have been most pertinent. Dopamine is dopamine in a human or a mouse. Sometimes the interesting thing is our unique use of the identical substrate. Dopamine facilitates a mouse's pressing of a lever in the hopes of getting some food, and a human's praying in the hopes of entering heaven. But some human behaviors stand alone, without precedent in another species. One of the most important realms of human uniqueness comes down to one simple fact, namely, that this is not a horse. Anatomically modern humans emerged around 200,000 years ago. But behavioral modernity had to wait more than another 150,000 years, as evidenced by the appearance in the archaeological record of composite tools, ornamentation, ritualistic burial, and that stunning act of putting pigment on the wall of a cave. This is not a horse. It's a great picture of a horse. When René Magritte placed the words, "Ceci n'est pas une pipe," this is not a pipe, beneath a picture of a pipe in his 1928 painting, The Treachery of Images, he was highlighting the shaky nature of imagery. The art historian Robert Hughes writes that this painting is a visual booby trap set off by thought, and that this sense of slippage between image and object is one of the sources of modernist disquiet. Magritte's goal was to magnify and play with the distance between an object and its representation. These are coping mechanisms against that modernist disquiet. But for that human putting pigment to wall in Lascaux Cave more than 17,000 years ago, the point was the opposite: to minimize the distance between the two, to be as close as possible to possessing the real horse. As we say, to capture its likeness, to gain its power as imbued in a symbol. The clearest human mastery of symbolism comes with our use of language. Suppose you are being menaced by something and thus scream your head off. Someone listening can't tell if the blood-curdling "Aye!" is in response to an approaching comet, suicide bomber, or Komodo dragon. It just means that things are majorly not right. The message is the meaning. Most animal communication is about such present tense emotionality. Symbolic language brought huge evolutionary advantages. This can be seen even in the starts of symbolism of other species. When vervet monkeys, for instance, spot a predator, they don't generically scream. They use distinct vocalizations, different proto-words, where one means predator on the ground, run up the tree, and another means predator in the air, run down the tree. Evolving the cognitive capacity to make that distinction is mighty useful, as it prompts you to run away from, rather than toward, something intent on eating you. Language pries apart a message from its meaning, and as our ancestors improved at this separation, advantages accrued. We became capable of representing past and future emotions, as well as messages unrelated to emotion. We evolved great expertise at separating message from reality, which, as we've seen, requires the frontal cortex to regulate the nuances of face, body, and voice. Lying. This capacity creates complexities that no one else, from slime mold to chimp, deals with in life's prisoner's dilemmas. The height of the symbolic features of language is our use of metaphor. And this is not just flourish metaphors when we declare that life is a bowl of cherries. Metaphors are everywhere in language. We may literally and physically be in a room, but we are only metaphorically inside something when we are in a good mood, in cahoots with someone, in luck, a funk, a groove, or love. We are only metaphorically standing under something when we understand it. The renowned cognitive linguist George Lakoff of UC Berkeley has explored the ubiquity of metaphor in language in books such as Metaphors We Live By with philosopher Mark Johnson and Moral Politics, How Liberals and Conservatives Think, where he demonstrates how political power involves controlling metaphors. Do you favor choice or life? Are you tough on crime, or does your heart bleed? Are you loyal to a fatherland or a motherland? And have you captured the flag of family values from your opponent? For Lakoff, language is always a metaphor, transferring information from one individual to another by putting thought into words, as if words were shopping bags. Symbols, metaphors, analogies, parables, synecdoche, figures of speech. We understand that a captain wants more than just hands when ordering all of them on deck, that Kafka's Metamorphosis isn't really about a cockroach, and that June doesn't really bust out all over. if we are of a certain theological ilk, we see bread and wine intertwined with body and blood. We learn that the orchestral sounds constituting the 1812 overture represent Napoleon getting his ass kicked when retreating from Moscow, and that Napoleon getting his ass kicked represents thousands of soldiers dying cold and hungry far from home. This chapter explores the neurobiology of some of the most interesting outposts of symbolic and metaphorical thinking. It makes a key point. These capacities evolved so recently that our brains are, if you will, winging it and improvising on the fly when dealing with metaphor. As a result, we are actually pretty lousy at distinguishing between the metaphorical and literal, at remembering that it's only a figure of speech, with enormous consequences for our best and worst behaviors. We start with examples of odd ways our brains handle metaphor and the behavioral manifestations of those oddities. Some have been introduced previously. Feeling someone else's pain. Consider the following. You stub your toe.